of walking and psychogeography and so on. And he, at that time, gave a long introduction to me. I don't want to repeat any of that for people who weren't there or who don't know anything about what I do. I'll simply say that I'm someone who's hung around in one part of the world for a very long time, spending 40 years in Hackney in London, which has become quite a peculiar thing to do. And also, during most of that time, I've been writing books and have now produced about 40 of them. And I'm going to reflect on those things. And what emerged from the earlier session this afternoon, which was interesting, we got off on a lot of riffs about what walking means, what the practice of walking means. Is it a spiritual discipline? Is it a different way of seeing the world? Is it a way of engaging with the particulars of the local places? Is it a way of energizing yourself in relation to other people? And all of that was fine. But at the end, what came up was that people came and asked me, this is all very well, and you've obviously used walking as a critique of a lot of social developments you see around you, but what is your solution? Now, this was an absolute stopper for me. What is my solution? In a sense, the writer is so privileged in that you describe, but you don't have to propose a solution. Politicians propose solutions. Theologians propose solutions. Certain forms of belief allow you a structure where there is a solution. The writer is this person with a different kind of responsibility, because the responsibility is to their text. It's not to preordain any form of behavior in the world. So I began to think about what was proposed by one of the major walks I've undertaken, which was a circumnavigation of London by walking around the acoustic footprint, so-called, of the M25. If the M25 motorway was a symbol of everything that was slow and horrible and difficult and dirty about London, what happens when you walk around the edge of it? 12 different walks that carried me around the entire distance of London as an organic entity. So that in a sense the city was a different thing when I finished and when I started. And so was I. Apart from having got through various shoes, socks and walking companions who came and went, I was a different person. I'd walked in what they call the acoustic footprints of the motorway. That's the distance back from the road that you can still hear it. The highway planters are responsible for planting this agency, and the highway planners told me that they had actually planted more trees than any other forest in Britain around the M25. And they have to do this section by section with variety. And that's not to be aesthetically pleasing. It's done to keep the drivers awake. So there's novelty, so that you see one landscape and you barely register it. The next one looks slightly different. And parts of Surrey, the planting is done as a buffer because of these rich communities that are hidden by the road. They don't want to see the road. They want to pretend it's not there. But it very much is there. And what it is now the equivalent of what the River Thames used to be. It's the working river. The road has become the working river, doing all the donkey work and the dirty work of London. And the river itself has become something else. It's become a kind of heritage backdrop where we're all arguing over what the meaning is, what parts of the past we want to retain, what do we do with the theatres and churches, do we keep them, do we open them, all of these things are quite big questions. But what I found by completing the walk, the conclusion, such as it was that nothing is finished. All that happens when you undertake the conclusion of one walk, I'm back at Waltham Abbey, where I started. I'm looking at the judgment painting in the abbey there and contemplating the grave of King Harold. I'm in a sense bereft of some activity that I've done for a long period of time, because I don't have a particular theology or a doctrine. The walk itself became a way of engaging with the world. I was somebody who walked. I was sitting at home and working and writing, but one day every month out I went into this landscape and I found the next chapter of the story. I picked it up where it finished. And I found things that I didn't know about. I found that what that road defined was that out there were these huge Victorian hospitals. They were built there at a certain distance from the centre of the city to take the people who were damaged, disturbed, often just people who were put away for socially inconvenient reasons. They were hidden away in these great hospitals at the edge of the city. At one point, the town of Epsom had a population that was 50% inside the hospital, 50% outside. And when they took those hospitals away and turned them into housing developments, you would actually find former inmates of the hospital wandering around this town trying to locate the place where they had been, their centre, their home. It was gone and it was lost. So they're disturbing places. And I also found that during the period of the walk, which was just before the year 2000, many of those hospitals disappeared from the map. And the histories of the people in the hospitals also disappeared from the map, because as we passed by them, skips outside were full of the names and records and lives of huge communities of Londoners that were just being burnt. So because the people moving into gated communities did not want to be reminded of the fact of the dark history that lay beyond. There's always this question of how you deal with the dark history. They didn't know. Well, how I dealt with it was also to do with an asylum, and it was to do with a particular asylum in Epping Forest, which is very close to Waltham Abbey. And coming through on that final leg of the walk was a cold night and a dark night in winter, the rain coming down, the headlights of the cars streaming at you. There's nowhere to go off the road into Epping Forest. And I realised we're passing Fairmead in Epping, which was a little hospital run in the period when the Romantic poet John Clare was alive. This is in the 1830s and 40s, as an asylum. Not in the sense of these huge lunatic asylums, but as in a sense of a small community wherein certain people were kept. And Clare, John Clare, worked in the forest and walked in the forest and lived in the forest for a period of years and then took off for a walk. And I realized, in a sense, crossing his path, and it's a thing John Davis, who walked on the M62 from Hull to Liverpool, talks about quite a lot. When you're out on the road in this sort of sense of reverie and dreamlike state you get into walking long, long distances, you do meet with ghosts. You do meet with people who appear at the right time. Once we were completely lost in a forest. We'd taken the wrong track when I was walking on another walk from London to Hastings. And magically, an old lady appears, sort of almost like one of those mushroom-picking ladies in a fairy story, out of nowhere, and says, you turn left, you take this path, and you're through. And these kind of figures would always emerge, always at the right time, always there to put you onto the right track. And I thought of them as permanent ghosts in the landscape. They were kind of benevolent figures, as if we were attended by some sort of angelic double who was ready, if you came to the right place with the right question, to point you in the right way. And I think that only emerges when you've been walking for a long, long time. You get into a particular state of mind. You begin to read the very small signs. And even though often the landowners will try and put you astray, there will be somebody there who emerges to put you right. The worst culprits in this particular territory on the edge of things are the golf courses, the private golf courses. They really hate walkers. We came across one in Sussex, whereby the post showing the green way was chopped down and chucked into a wood, and burnt out cars had been put across the path to stop the flow of the walkers. So an entire morning and most of the afternoon was spent circling round and round this to try and reconnect with something, just because you've been stymied by this golf course where everybody is running around in mechanical buggies. Really horrible. So in a sense, you have to learn to circumnavigate that and to behave in a different way. And what I found then, having completed this walk, was that the gate was opening to another walk, and the ghost that I was connecting with was the poet John Clare. Now, I don't know how much you would know about John Clare, so I'll probably be telling you things you already know, but I'll just outline who he was. He was a short man, a sturdy man. He grew up in a village called Helpston, which is north of Peterborough, right on the edge of the Fens. And what was remarkable about him, in a sense, was that poetry possessed him, despite himself. It wasn't as if he was coming from a family that had any connection with poetry. There was no expectation on him becoming a poet. In fact, it was regarded as a kind of sign, the first incipient sign, that there was something wrong with him. He became a poet. He was working in the fields as a boy, and he heard of a poem, The Seasons, by Thomson. He heard one of his colleagues reading this book, and he decided he would have to have it. And he paid somebody else that morning to look after the horses for him, and he walked into the town of Stamford, again walking, because walking was the only way to move across this landscape. It was a walk of about 8-9 miles, and he was there before the bookshop opened, bought the book, came home at Burley House. He lay down, he climbed over the wall, trespassed into Burley House, lay under a tree and read this quite formal description of landscape and the seasons by Thomson, and knew that he'd become a poet, like it was a kind of vocation and it was a kind of curse. So here he is, a country boy. He knows he's going to do this, but the writing of the poems have to become a secret. And he lives in a village which is quite peculiar, because it's on the great limestone causeway that runs across England from Bath. You can see it, the Cotswold Stone that goes right through to the town of Stamford. He lives on the edge of that, and the quarries are nearby. But then beyond is the Fens, which is flat and dark and dangerous and full of other kinds of ghosts, memories of the Vikings coming up the river. People there travel by water rather than by land, and he doesn't want to go into that. So where he is, he's still on land. He's got a bit of a hill behind him. And he hides out in the woods. He hides out in hollow trees. And he scribbles the poems on bits of brown paper scavenged from his mother. He keeps them in his hat. And he is a poet. And this is an extraordinary thing to be. But the vogue was then in place for peasant poets. People wanted a landscape poetry. They liked the idea of a poem being written by someone who was apparently a sort of simple countryman. Therefore, he had to come to London. Therefore, he had to present himself in a different way. He was like a sort of celebrity of the moment. Here he was. Everybody wanted to see him. Coleridge met him. De Quincey met him. He was living in London when he first came, about 100 yards from where William Blake was living, though neither of them knew each other or came across each other. And that kind of difficulty of living this double life, not knowing quite who he was, eventually contributed to what appeared to be his madness, which was the inability to live where he was in this village, and the inability to be in London either. He was creating a sort of schizophrenic situation for himself, and eventually the solution was to go into Dr. Allen's asylum in Epping Forest, which of course returned him to a kind of countryside where he'd been and put him back into the position of being a farm labourer as he saw it, which is what he'd got away from in the first place. But there were other things haunting him too. There was the figure of Mary Joyce, who was a young girl he'd met at school and who he obsessed about as being his muse. She was the spirit he felt strongly about, rather than his actual wife, Patty, the mother of his many children. And he felt that he was being held in Epping Forest in this asylum for the crime of bigamy, because he had two wives, with a spiritual wife and the earthly wife. But the real root, I think, of most of the trouble came from something else, which was, this was the period of agricultural enclosures. It had been decided that the common land, the open land which surrounded the village of Glinton, was no longer going to be common. It was going to be divided up into small pieces. And the energetic local peasantry, or the small labourers of the area, managed to acquire little bits of land and kind of came up in life. And others were totally dispersed and dispossessed and had nowhere to go. And so instead of being able to walk as he always had in particular ways, that land was now forbidden to him. And the landscape which is actually the landscape of writing or walking or moving, is no longer available. You're not able to get into your world, and the world is his description, and therefore he's lost. And there's two things in a book I wrote about this, Claire and the Walk, it's called Edge of the Horizon, which makes this a little bit clearer. John Clare had to learn the difficult thing. In different places, we are different people. We live in one envelope with a multitude of voices, lulling them by regular habits of rising and labouring and eating and taking pleasure and exercise. Other selves in suspension slumber but remain wakeful. Walking confirms identity. We are never more than an extension of the ground on which we live. The birds knew him. They knew John Clare, a wanderer in the fields and woods. They recognized him and he belonged. They proved the right to common air. He shared their heat. 23 years fixed in Helpston, between limestone outcrop and fen, flailing, herding, stalking the circle, minor expeditions, runs at the horizon, the child lost among the yellow firs of Emmonsales Heath, the crabbed adolescent on a barge from Peterborough to Wisbeach, the hot young man tramping to Newark, the lime burner landing himself with a wife. On an invisible leash, Clare was drawn back to his hut, his home, his hovel. Poetry is a form of going away, of holding landscape and its overwhelming simultaneous particulars in the float of memory. For Clare, as for all poets in the Romantic tradition, wrote Jonathan Bate, writing was the place of remembering, of preserving what was lost, childhood, first love, moments of vision, glimpses of ordinary things made extraordinary by virtue of the attention bestowed upon them. Without loss, there is no reason for poetry. Now, all of this happened very, very early on for John Clare, the peculiarity and the difference. As a very young child, he did something which I can remember doing too when we were talking about walking earlier this afternoon. I remember that when I was about 10 or so, I got the urge with friends, probably from reading Just William books or something, that what was needed, although I know the spot where I actually live, I need to push it out a bit further. And I walked from one town, a coal mining town called Mystaig, to the next town, which was about 10 miles away, called Bridge End, a market town, but walked along the roadside, went there. And I remember the kind of incredible sense of liberation in some ways in walking away into the unknown, which wasn't totally unknown because I'd driven the road, but seeing the road in a totally different way, simply because you don't look at every blade of grass, you don't go off into this field and that field. So it's a different thing. And I think this is a commonplace for children. But for Clare, when he did it, what he saw was this process of getting out of his knowledge. Once he'd gone beyond the place where he felt that the animals and the stones recognized him, he was nobody. He was nothing. He'd lost himself. And therefore he reached a kind of abyss that was a symbol of everything that would happen later in his life. And he wrote wonderful prose. I mean, he's known, obviously, for a nature poet and for a satirical poet as well. When he was in the asylum, he wrote satirical political poems as if in the spirit of Byron. But his prose is wonderfully muscular and strange. I had imagined that the world's end was the edge of the horizon, and that a day's journey was able to find it out. So I went with my heart full of hopes and pleasures and discoveries, expecting when I got to the brink of the world that I could look down like a looking into a large pit and see in it secrets, the same as I believed I could see heaven by looking into water. A very interesting experience, and an experience that happens to him in different ways all through his life. When he's in London, he was so nervous of the streets. He stayed at any event, social event he went to, till the very end, the death. He didn't want to go home. He didn't want to leave the people. And he actually hired a sort of Cockney guide to lead him back home. even though this guy took him the longest way round, like a taxi driver, and charged him for it. He was frightened of Chancery Lane. He was terrified that the paving stones would open up and he would drop into a cellar and disappear. And when he was making his original journey to London, there's this incredible moment. He goes, walks to Stamford, as he always had to start off, and the coach, London coach, takes all day. And he's just come out of Stamford, and he sees some men picking stones out of a field, and he looks at them, and he has this incredible bounced back vision when he puts himself among the men picking the stones, looking at the coach, and he can't decide whether he is himself someone now in a coach, a privilege he would never have expected to get, or whether he's out there in the fields picking stones and looking back at people passing in the coach. And he is both things, and he splits in that moment. And when he gets to London, he can't deal with London until he remaps it in terms of Stamford and the landscape he knows. They take him out to show him the River Thames the first evening, supposedly, you know, for a Wordsworthian epiphany. And he says, it's not as interesting as Whittlesea Mere. He goes to see Westminster Abbey and it becomes Peterborough Cathedral. Once he's got it in terms of his own mapping, then he can understand the city. And he used to sit for many, many hours at the publisher's window, Taylor the publisher in Fleet Street, and just look at this mass of people progressing, and drifting, moving down the city. But it doesn't work. He can't. What does he come back to? And when he's back in Helpston, it turns out that the cottage has been moved to the next village of Northborough, which is 1.5 miles away. But that's it. That's too much. He's that much deeper into the Fens. And although there's a benevolence, a patronage that the local landlords are giving him a better place to live, he can't do it. He can't be there. And so this lends to the breakdown and the final putting into the asylum in Epping Forest, which is the point where I connect with his ghost, as it were, as I walk in myself into Waltham Abbey. We're very exhausted. We've been walking. I don't know how far. If you walked right round the middle of the road, it's 120 miles around London. But obviously we were zigzagging, so it's probably double that. And you're arriving there and so tired that the sense of him being in the forest is palpable. And I realize that all that one walk does, and this is the thing about what you do, what you propose, all I can propose is that you always look for the next project. You always keep the thing alive. You always keep the momentum going. You roll on. There's always another quest. And the quest there clearly was to repeat John Clare's walk, which was this wonderful walk and terrible walk, when he decides he's had enough of being in this asylum after 4 years or so. And he just walks off to go home. He has no maps. He doesn't really know where he's going. He's met some gypsies in the forest. They've told him, you know, this is the way to the North Road, and we'll show you the way if you come back and meet us. But he comes back, they're gone. He finds a hat, picks up the hat. Off he goes on the road. He goes wrong. Someone in a pub shows him the right way to the Great North Road, and off he goes. He's nothing to eat. He's so hungry, he's gobbling the grass at the side of the road. He's chewing tobacco. Some farm labourers on horses chuck him a couple of coins. He gets some beer, and so on and so on until he arrives back in his own country. He recognises where he is in Peterborough, passes through Peterborough, gets to a town called Werrington, and an extraordinary thing happens. Farm cart is coming towards him because his family have been warned that he's returning, and his wife, Patty, is on the cart with his son. And he doesn't recognize them. He doesn't know who they are. They're complete strangers. And they pull him up onto the cart and tell him that Mary Joyce, that he's coming back to connect with, his muse that will make this whole thing work, is dead and died while he's in the hospital from burns. And the whole of his mapping, the whole of this epic journey, this wonderful thing that had a conclusion, he could see an end at last. He could see a shape. He was going back. He was going to find Mary Joyce. He was going to bring the two halves of his life, the spiritual, sensual, all together into one entity. He would write again. He would reclaim his home. All gone. And his wife tries him at home in Northborough, she says, for a few months. And then by the Christmas of that year, he's put into asylum in Northampton, where he spends the rest of his life. He never tries to walk away again, even though it's much closer to his home, and he could have done it easily. He didn't do it. He stayed there the rest of his life. And the conclusion was to write some quite tragic poems about the state of division from himself. He questions his own identity, and he writes poems as if he was Byron and all of that, and people come to see him. So in a sense, it's very difficult to give a conclusion, to tell you what you should do, how you should do. I've been talking a lot in the book I've done on Hackney about the kind of blight that comes with development. We're in an age of the grandest projects now. You've got things like the huge Olympic project going on, which impinges onto the Clare territory. And as a consequence of that, you can see the vanishing of allotments, you can see travellers being dispersed, exactly the same kind of the inheritors of the people that John Clare met in Epping Forest, they've gone. Dissident artists, people living in industrial warehouses and so on, all of that goes and goes over a very short period of time and is replaced by a quite frantic period of building and designing of transport hubs, huge estates growing up. Now, this has created a kind of profound schizophrenia in the nature of the people that live on the edge of that area. Some of them are positive and responsive, and I think, you know, in a sense, this legacy is something that you're going to get a makeover of the place we live. It will be a better place to live. And others feel deeply disturbed because they've lost things that meant so much to them. So the challenge again is, what would you do about it? What would you propose for this area? And I think all you can propose, in a sense, is that the area is allowed to maintain its own identity, that we don't feel the need constantly to revise and make over, but simply to make the best and come to terms with what's there and to draw out the story. I've never been to Berlin before, but in the last couple of weeks, I was invited to do a series of walks in Berlin over a few days. And this brought everything in Hackney, where I'd been living for so long, into real focus, because the problems there of what you do with memory are much more severe. For a start, in relatively recent history, you've got this wall, a physical wall that divided the city. And what do they do with it? Do they demolish it entirely and pretend it was never there? Well, they don't know. They've kept sections of it, which become almost like artworks. They've got other bits which are totally protected. There are sort of theme parks. Somebody at the Trafford Centre in Manchester offered to take the wall and rebuild it as an attraction in the Trafford Centre, where they would dress up actors as border guards, and for a little extra fee you could be interrogated. And maybe that's sort of crazy as it is. It kind of fits with the new landscape of retail parks and sort of weird hangars that are out there on the edge of things, representing a new kind of Britain, which is the landscape you walk through on the M25, or you walk through on those great roads around the edge of nowhere, which are kind of spiritless and soulless, and everywhere looks just like somewhere else. I found in Berlin there were zones where an even more painful history, obviously, of the Nazi era was there, and what would you do with it? Now, the debate about what was done about it is much more fierce than in London. In London, it's, you know, can we put up the Globe Theatre, which is a facsimile of the Elizabethan Globe Theatre, kind of fake that's completely authentic and not quite where it used to be, but put it there, and it draws tourists, and it has a kind of heritage aspect that plays along with the river. Where in Berlin you have this area where the Gestapo had their headquarters. Now, what do you do about that? Do you just wipe all trace of it from the face of the earth as if this story didn't happen in this city? And what they did was a kind of curious solution of pinning the stories of various victims, and not only that, but also the oppressors, all of them, to a fence, and which you walk. So it becomes a walk, an open-air walk, reading these stories, meditating on the history of what had happened here, and you have a fragment of the actual original site visible, the cellars beneath, and beyond it, the one of the main buildings has now been converted into a museum of decorative arts, and alongside the whole thing runs the wall. So you've got 3, 4, 5 historical narratives arguing with each other, but they are there, and you go as a tourist or you go as anybody else, you have to interrogate the history of what the city was. Really, just close by to this Potsdamer Platz, which if you saw, say, in a film like Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire, it was a wasteland, an extraordinary, not very long ago, a complete wasteland, desert. It had been a great square in the 1920s. It had been obliterated because of the course of the wall through the city. And it was just rubble. And then it becomes reinvented, not a million miles from the Trafford Centre or Westfield. It's taken over as the Sony Centre. And it has a dome on it like this. So it's not inside, it's not outside. And as part of the remit of doing this, you keep an old 1920s hotel is not destroyed. They put it on rails and shoved it into a corner. So it's like a kind of quotation. Very bizarre. And these things happen all the way. And I think the way to deal with all that is to walk. My way of dealing with it is to walk between these sites and to think about the sites and to see what they mean. And so I walked in the day I was in Berlin from what would have been in East Berlin, Alexanderplatz, having gone up the famous TV Tower, which was once the second tallest structure in Europe. You could see the whole spread of the city. You just walk down the great avenue, Unter den Linden, through the Brandenburg Gates and out towards their Olympic Stadium, built in 1936, and compare and contrast what's happened there with that stadium, what it meant, with what I see happening in London now. Because everything is a kind of reflection of something else. And only by moving about between them do we begin to get a sense of how it impacts on us and how we should deal with it, which is what John Clare, in a sense, was not privileged to do, because he was so deeply into the possession of the voices that made him a poet, and a sense that because that had happened to him, he should be a privileged human entity. People should appreciate at the time what he was doing and respond to him and buy his books. And it didn't happen. People exploited him as if he was an interesting phenomenon and then put him aside. And as a dreamer, a ghost, he's abandoned to the fringes of the city. Everything interesting goes out, the fringes of the city, then he's gone, and then he undertakes this mad walk to reclaim his own identity. And he doesn't, but he does leave behind him this phenomenal piece of prose, handwritten, which I had to go to Northampton Library and see the original text and transcribe it, which was a wonderful experience to actually just follow those words, walking across the page and create something and realize that that's what he's left. That's the conclusion. That's all that any writer in the end leaves, is these things, these strange things, books, voices, arguments, accidents. They can't propose solutions. They're not politicians. They're not religious leaders. But they make evidence available in different ways. They make connections that maybe you don't think about. They suggest that you take walks, and that taking a walk is a form of reading or a form of meditation or a form of spiritual discipline. It's there all the time in all the history of culture. I mean, I'm thinking of the kind of Beat Generation poets who suddenly found themselves crisscrossing America or walking to the tops of mountains and exhausting themselves and coming back and reducing it to haiku poems, whatever it would be. I think so. That is my sole message in the end, is to sharpen the faculties, take the journey, respond, and come to places like this, and to make it part of a sequence and a series. Give it a shape. I think we shape, but we do not conclude. And at the end of making of shapes, we just look for the next pattern. Coming here was is the end for me of a long walk I've been doing this year. From the standard walk, a lot of people have done it, from the mouth of the Thames, up the Thames to the source, which is not too far away. And what happened in the course of this was that I needed a point to start from. How do you define the point at which the Thames starts? You're looking at the North Sea. Well, there is an obelisk called the London Stone, which stands on the Isle of Grain and is opposite another stone in Essex called the Crow Stone. And these two obelisks look at each other across, and that is given as a definition of where the Thames starts. So having walked as far as Reading, I realized that even though I'd come right close to this thing, I hadn't actually touched the stone. It niggled me, you know, I wanted to go back, I wanted to say, touch the stone, I've actually started at the right place. So I went back, and I spent a whole day wandering through the Isle of Grain to try and get to this stone. And what you discover when you look at the map is you can't get to the stone because it's a secret state, it's military, it's covered in fences. There's something going on there, I don't know what, but it doesn't get onto the Ordnance Survey map. And so you can't walk down the Cockle Beach, you can't get there, it's impossible. But I couldn't accept that, you know. I'm mad enough to think that it was so important by this stage to get to this stone, you had to find other solutions. So I came back again and detoured miles and miles round and came, and again I'd always land up at some police cottages and someone would tell you to go away. So what do you do? And this is a kind of metaphor. Do you say you're doing something wrong, you can't do it, or do you feel, as I did, that the whole walk, the whole of this Thames walk, was not going to mean anything unless you could find the solution to touching this stone, which was the start and was therefore very important to be at. So I figured out if you got persuaded someone with a kayak to come from one side, we could go across very early in the morning before anyone was around, actually paddle across and get off to that stone, touch the stone, that was it. So I met someone, a photographer, Stephen Gill, who's got a kayak. We struggled down to this very early in the morning. It's mad because there's a howling gale and the river is ripping in. We're going to disappear. And then I saw a miracle because actually at that moment, the Yantlet Creek, there's no water in it. It's gone, the tide has gone miles out and you actually can hop across. So we abandon this kayak, hop across. And you're on a beach as if nobody's ever been on it before. It's like Robinson Crusoe, perfect smooth beach, and you can get to the London Stone. And I see what it is. It's actually a list of names of old sea captains and admirals. It's almost like the thing itself is the mast of some wonderful raft that sunk at this point, and they've carved their names on this. And you can only get to it at this point of low tide. The tide comes in and the thing sticks out. But having got there, I realized this is it. And then afterwards, the whole idea of this Thames walk, the kind of pastoral gentleness, in a sense, there's no hardship in the walk. You drift through and you see all the kind of weirdness of England emerging. Makes some sense because there's been a difficulty, but you can't ever avoid that. And you will see things that are so strange that you couldn't imagine them. One of the walks, as I approached Reading, it was in the winter, and the Thames had actually frozen, and a rowing eight had come out of Reading, sort of slamming away, and because they can't see behind them, they've gone straight into the middle of the ice, and they don't know why they've stopped. And there's a scratching of these oars, and they look around, and it's like they've suddenly got into the polar regions, and they're completely fixed. And how do you get out of it? Because the oars just scratch on the ice. You can't push, you can't do anything. It's a kind of perfect image of futility. And you would only see that if you were doing a kind of long-distance walk where you stumble on it. And you notice it among hundreds and hundreds of other odd things. And I think that's the answer too, is simply to be aware and to keep your eyes open and to see how a story of a poet who's destroyed by the nature of enclosures relates to the enclosures that happen in London when suddenly one day you get up and there's a blue fence across a landscape that you've known for so long. And I met an old guy down there who'd been coming into this landscape, he told me, for 40 years. He'd been photographing every change in the Lower Lee Valley. He'd logged all the wildlife in the marshes. And that day, for the first time ever, he wasn't allowed to proceed because there was this fence going up and there was a grand project. He said, you know, I'm sorry, if you take a photograph, we'll confiscate your camera. And at this confiscation, so at the same time, banks and banks of surveillance cameras were photographing him, but he was not allowed to take an image. And the age of the virtual had come, that the images on the fence were of things that don't exist. They've actually made computer-generated versions of a perfected England with wonderful stadiums. Some of them are never going to be built. Wonderful orchards, fields, everything is perfect, but it doesn't exist. But people actually believe it does. I've had students in Cambridge discussing this. They didn't know anything about the allotments, they don't know anything about the travellers, they don't know about anything else, but they've seen the future in the form of this computer-generated thing and said it's fantastic, they love it. But it's not there. And the image-making, the process of taking an ordinary analogue image or something else in this site is completely forbidden. When you do a tour of the Olympic site in a bus, and you ask if you take a photograph out of the window, even of a pylon or a duck or anything else, you're not allowed to. It's completely forbidden. So the kind of control of imagery has taken over our lives in quite a serious way. And unless we can reclaim the process in some other way, this is what I would suggest, is simply a new sense of awareness, a new sense of sharpness, getting to know wherever you are and pushing out into the world from that point. Okay, I think I'll stop there so that there's kind of opportunity for us anything that you know you'd like to discuss or anything in general or particular. I'd be very happy to try and do questions.
I'm most interested in this idea of John Clare and the book that you've written
which.
Sorry, can you hear me? Okay, I'm most interested in your book on John Clare because I wrote my undergraduate dissertation on John Clare. And I was wondering if you could give me your views on this idea of his wandering feet versus his wandering mind and this idea of whether or not he was mad and how the two are connected, the idea of him wandering around and this affecting his thoughts that he puts on the page. But then the idea that if he does go mad, that then sends his feet on this crazy walk back home. I was wondering if you could expand on that.
Yeah, I don't believe that his walking and wandering was a cause, you know, or a symptom of his madness, but really a kind of journey into a sanity against the forces that were pulling him apart. I mean, the sense of exclusion from his own landscape with the enclosures, the social difficulties of his position in being a poet, all of these things were the provocations of his disturbance and his madness, apart from not knowing genetically what his particular package is, because his ancestry, there's a figure that wanders into the village and, you know, they don't know who he is. There's all of that. So the walking, I think, becomes a way of forming an alternative reality that he pushes out as a sort of correlation with his writing is that he undertakes a series of journeys and they are the markers of his life, from the journey he takes when he, as a sort of teenager, he walks right away from the whole village to try and find another job and another life after he leaves Burley. He goes on this journey by water to Wisbeach when they try him out to find a job. And all of these journeys take him to a secondary stage in his life. And I think it's only when he's trapped in Matthew Allen's asylum in Epping that the nature of him being mad becomes a definition. As long as he's in freedom and in movement, I think he's managing to balance his demons. And then he's suddenly in one place and it all becomes too much. And this is when he starts adapting a voice of Lord Byron or whatever, and he could clinically be seen to be in a mad condition. And his way out of it is to undertake this enormous walk, which might seem to be mad, but actually was a journey towards a higher form of sanity. Well, that's my reading of it.
Can I ask a couple of questions about the Thames walk? One is, you described the mouth of the Thames as the start, and I would have taken the source as the start. The start of your walk was the start of the Thames, which was the mouth. Is that intentional use of language? And the other question, if in two parts, you mentioned touching the stone on the Isle of Grain in order to mark the start, the significance of that. What about the other side, the Essex stone?
Okay.
As an Essex resident, it matters.
I think this was a double question about whether you walk from source outwards or whether you start at the estuary and come in. And I think that's kind of big time a question of temperament, among other things. Obviously, in Peter Ackroyd's book on the Thames, He starts here at the source, which is a kind of logical, chronological thing to do. But for me, the kind of great swirl of narrative and everything else is where the Thames goes out into the world ocean. The reason why London is what it is because of this connection and the excitement of the river there with all of the great container ships and the memories of Joseph Conrad setting off on his voyages. In a sense, it's a story that's familiar to me, and I wanted to start with the familiar and the known and the exciting, and another area that's being remade through the Thames Gateway. So all of that was what I wanted to be in. I wanted to start in the maelstrom and then trace the thread right back to its source. And I think there are big philosophical, spiritual, whatever reasons for whichever way you decide to do that. That was the way for me. Taking time backwards in a way. As to whether I'd done on the other side, I had, earlier on, done a journey essentially following the A13 road as if it was a river, again, from Aldgate Pump, right through Southend to the sea. And in the course of that, touched base with the stone on the other side. It became part of not a starting point, but it was just an interesting passage in a longer walk that was doing something else, taking me from the city to the sea. So again, what I'm saying is that journey after journey after journey is invented as a recapitulation of the same theme. That always there's a journey with some kind of beginning, some kind of resolution, but at the end, all you discover is that you need to set off on another one. Redefine it, maybe cross where you've passed before and see if it means the same thing.
Hello. Sorry, I've got the microphone. There's a big retrospective of the artist Richard Long at the moment in the Tate Britain, and his art very much focuses on walking through the landscape as well. And he starts, I think, with making marks by way of his walking, and then moves on to add in works where he's describing in very spare words what he finds when he's walking. And I wondered, I haven't heard it called psychogeography, I wondered whether you felt there was any connection at all between your two modes of working.
There are a number of connections with Richard Long's work. Richard Long's work, I remember vividly a spiral from an exhibition in the Whitechapel Gallery, which is in the territory I'm writing about all the time. But when I was working in Truman's Brewery a lot of years ago, I went into the Whitechapel Gallery and found this spiral by Richard Long on the floor and felt very much the urge to describe it and to imagine that spiral, even though it was not made with any relation to be shown in London. It was a perfect symbol for the kind of maze of the inner city and for Whitechapel. So I looked at that. And the exact crossover of psychogeographic practice and Richard Long, I think, comes with Bill Drummond. Bill Drummond has a wonderfully kind of embattled relationship with what Richard Long does. He's very attracted to it, but he wants to argue with it in some ways. And he set out as an exercise to walk his own name, Bill, into the map of London. So he drew it out and he walked this shape. And where it finished, quite by accident, was exactly opposite a gallery where a Richard Long show was on. He went into it and he saw this photograph of a site in Iceland. And he spent all his money that was left from his famous burning of £1 million and all that. He spent something like £20,000 on buying this Richard Long, with the idea that he would, after a number of years contemplating it, because he loved Richard Long's work, he would then resell it and burn the money in Iceland at the spot where the Richard Long... The trouble was that when he offered it for sale, nobody bought it. So then he cut the Richard Long picture into a grid and sold tiny squares for £1 each. And when he'd raised the money again, he theoretically was going to identify the spot in Iceland where Richard Long's photograph had been taken, burn it, bury the ashes in the ground. So there are kind of strange challenges and connections between the practice of doing odd things in the city and the kind of meditative stillness that you find in images by Richard Long. And Richard Long's walks are completely epic, but they're very rational in a sort of sense, in a mad way, that you'll walk from point A to point B, 24 hours walking in a dead straight line and doing such and such, and reduces it to maybe three or four words beautifully proposed. So the kind of nature of the two practices, I think, is different. The Richard Long one is very, very disciplined, and the other one is stranger and madder, but does definitely connect and interconnect with what Richard Long does. He's a background figure in the whole practice.
I'm afraid this will have to be the last question.
Sorry.
It might connect a little bit to that, but I've done a few walks myself, and I walked from Brick Lane up to the west coast of Scotland, but something that was important to me was getting up at the place where I went to bed and carrying on. And there's something that initially disappointed me about your book, London Orbital, because I found you're a commuter walker, or rather that you, in a sense, your research is as much your walk as the walk itself. And I'm just curious about how the journey in your walks are often broken walks, or they're journeys as much in history and geography and stories and personalities as they are actually in the physical space.
Yes. I mean, this is true. You know, that's what I do. They are broken walks. And as I said at the beginning, it's kind of walking as writing. It is a kind of, they're walks undertaken to sort out my particular thoughts on history, the fabric of place, and they've got to be somehow available to me to do in bursts where I can then return and write. And really the writing is the walking rather than the walk itself. I've never taken off on these epic fugues like in the French, Albert Dada took off from somewhere in mid-France and walked to Moscow. I'm seriously epic walks that mean something completely other. I've never done that. That's not what I do. And I think, in a sense, those kind of walks would be so all-consuming and that the need to write anything might fall away entirely. And I want to hang on to the practice of writing.
You do it very well.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ian Sinclair.